Hey, how's it going, everybody? This is Chris. Welcome to episode 14 of NML Crossing, where we're going to be looking at the second of the three one-shots for the Cataclysm storyline. And it's one that, there's something about it. It has nothing to do with the story, but there is something about it that vexes me. And this is probably the silliest of Chris problems, but it's the title. Title of the book here, and I think I touched upon this toward the end of last episode, but the title on the cover doesn't match the title in the indicia. And for lizard-brained morons like myself, that that kind of screws up how I file things in my, unwieldy Excel spreadsheet that I use to organize and maintain my collection. The book we're going to be covering today, if you were to look at the cover, is Batman Huntress Spoiler Blunt Trauma Number 1. But if you were to look at the indicia, it's Batman Spoiler Huntress Blunt Trauma Number 1. I mean, I don't know. I don't know why that happens. I guess I say this simply so I can ask the question, does the indicia affect you the way it affects me? Which is very, very precious. It's very precious and ridiculous. But I wonder those things here. I don't use like a comic collecting app. I promoted an app on old shows, but with the glut of variant covers and not and exclusives and not knowing which things to pick, and sometimes barcodes read wrong, and it, for me it's just easier to type it into an Excel spreadsheet, and I usually will defer to the indicia to do so. Like, let's go over to the X-Men. For a few years before the name was officially changed to Uncanny X-Men, the cover said Uncanny X-Men. But if you look at the indicia, it's just X-Men, right? So how do you log that? Do you log Uncanny X-Men 125 or just X-Men 125? Or do you wait until it's Uncanny X-Men 142 when it's officially changed in the indicia? I don't know. I think about things like one-off changes in the indicia. I recently, while I was doing The Essential X lapsed in trying to fill in as many, one-off appearances and non-X-book appearances of X characters, or just plain mutants in general. I went in hard on the New Defenders. And that one was weird because the cover said New Defenders for years before they changed it to the New Defenders. It was just Defenders. And then there was like an issue in the middle of it where the cover said Sergeant Fury and his Howling Defenders. And the indicia said that. So it's like, dude, how do you... I can appreciate that this is the stupidest conversation you're likely to hear today. And it's a conversation that even having it with myself is kind of cringe and embarrassing. But I don't know. I don't know if these are among the commonalities of comic fans and enthusiasts. This sort of weird, very, very niche-y, within a niche sort of... I don't know, just the minutiae of comics fandom and the nuances of how we organize things. So, what do you do with a book like this? What do you do with a book like Huntress/Spoiler or Spoiler/Huntress? Well, I begrudgingly filed it as Huntress/Spoiler since that's what it said on the cover. I second-guessed the decision to the point where it's, ridiculous. Very, very ridiculous. Oh, that's another one. That's another one. I just came to mind here. Green Lantern, Green Arrow. There was that iconic O'Neill Adams run, Green Lantern, Green Arrow, where the cover said one thing, but the indicia, for a lot of it, said another. How do you log that? I don't know. I'm gonna stop wasting your time here, and we'll just get into the issue. Apologies for the brain drain right there, but let's get into it. Today, we're going to be discussing that second one-shot, Batman Huntress Spoiler Blunt Trauma Number 1, May 1998, or Batman Spoiler Huntress Blunt Trauma Number 1, May 1998. Story's called Cataclysm, Part 13, Blunt Trauma, written by Chuck Dixon, with pencils by Eduardo Barreto, inks Bill Sienkiewicz, colors Jason Wright, letters Tim Harkins, edits Vincenzo Peterson, cover price $2.95, so a dollar more expensive than the rest of the Batman line. Now our story opens at Gotham City's Westerberg Mall, where Stephanie Brown is shopping with a real skeezy-looking character named Dean. Now, dude looks kind of like if early mid-90s Image Comics was given a humanoid form. Like this white dude with a chin beard and dreads, a flannel shirt, Doc Martens. And I mean, nothing wrong with flannels and docs. Lord knows I was probably dressing just like this guy. And probably well into the 2000s, and probably not too long ago. But still, a very dated-looking dude. And skeezy. Can't forget skeezy. He looks pretty gross. Anyway, a hunk of debris falls from the second story of the mall, and Stephanie manages to tackle Skeezy Dean out of the way just in the nick of time. Dean, like pretty much all of our Gotham hot takes so far, assumes that the mall's been bombed, attacked by terrorists. Now, Stephanie's not so quick to jump to that conclusion. She doesn't think that was the case since there weren't any nearby explosions. Dean gets up, complains that his dad's gonna totally kill him if his car's dented, and leaves. He just leaves Stephanie there. Now our gal attempts to appeal to his inner first responder, citing that, you know, they could and probably should be helping those in need. Dean's all, F that noise, smell you later, and he is outie. We shift scenes to rejoin Huntress, who we haven't seen since, I can't remember if that was Batman 553 or Detective 720. It's been a minute, is all I'm saying. When last we did leave her, she was working her way through the subway tunnels, and it's here where she emerges into the daylight. Meanwhile, we visit with those Blackgate escapees who took advantage of that temporary land bridge to make their way from the island into Gotham City proper. Now, we saw this happen in that last one-shot, Blackgate Isle of Men. Now, our gaggle of geeks include Cluemaster, Arthur Brown, Stephanie Brown's deadbeat dad, Ernie Chubb, Zonk, Titus Zonka, a.k.a. The Baffler, Dragon Cat, Philip Parsons, Firefly, Garfield Linz, Monsoon, and Ratcatcher, Otis Flanagan. Now, Arthur is pretty much taking the lead in the escape, which, I mean, stands to reason, it's a spoiler story. Now, this doesn't really go over too well with Ernie Chubb. He is not too pleased about this. And so Artie pulls a piece on him and nearly gets his head yoinked off like a bottle cap for it. Lucky for him, Monsoon delivers some sort of like an ear clap to Chubb, which knocks his ass out. The goons then plan their next move and decide to head over to the mall in order to slip into some civvies and maybe secure some cash. They all head off except Firefly, who, much like his name suggests, might just be a fire fetishist. He takes a moment to enjoy the raging inferno that once was Gotham City. Back to the mall, and we get to see kind of a tale of two types. Two types of people, how they react and behave in the face of disaster. One chooses to help their fellow man. The other loots. It's kind of like a Goofus and Gallant sort of situation we got here. Stephanie, in her full spoiler togs, swoops in to deal with some of these looters, before spotting a baby in a very precarious and ridiculous situation. Like, it's kind of dumb. Now, this baby dropped her stuffed crocodile during the quake. This stuffed crocodile somehow wound up at the very end of an exposed hunk of debris, which is hung over like an abyss-like pit. The baby, ignoring the cries from her mother, crawls toward the toy. I mean, okay. Now, just as little Kimmy is about to plummet straight to hell, Stephanie springs into action. She nabs the tot and tosses it over to the waiting mother. Like, literally, it's like, yoink, poof, tosses it. Then she slips into the pit herself. Lucky for her, this is where Huntress arrives. She swings in to save Spoiler from her seemingly endless fall. Looks like this is their first meeting, and Spoiler is, well, not exactly fangirling, but seems somewhat excited to be meeting Helena. Now, Steph notices Huntress's wounded shoulder. She was shot in that issue of either Batman or Detective, and she goes to tend to it. She explains that Robin showed her how to properly dress wounds, which informs Huntress that they well, they have some people in common. Helena makes a passive-aggressive comment about how the Bat family knows far more about the two of them than vice versa. She then drops the news that this wasn't an attack, this wasn't a bombing, this was an earthquake, and the entirety of Gotham City now lay largely in ruin. Now, this chat is interrupted by shotgun fire, so the geeks are here. Zonk enters the scene blasting with a shotgun that he'd swiped from a nearby sporting goods store, or I guess a sporting goods store inside the mall. Now, we've only got a skeleton crew of security guards here to hold down the fort, and it's like two dudes, and they're currently pinned in, hiding. Spoiler and Huntress swoop in. A lot of swooping in this issue. I'll probably say it 100 more times. Anyway, they swoop in and they KO Big Zonk. Stephanie notes the sheer brutality that Huntress employs in taking out the trash, and she describes her approach as cold, professional, and cruel. Not at all like she's seen from the Bat folks and how they deal with bad guys. She suggests that this is maybe a bit more personal to Huntress. It's worth noting here, and I haven't mentioned it yet, but the narration captions that we get throughout this issue are from Stephanie Brown's diary. Like, it actually started with, like, a Dear Diary, and I think she mentions Dear Diary a bunch more times here. Now, speaking of personal, well, let's briefly rejoin Stephanie's dad. And it's a comedy scene. The Blackgate escapee all-stars are out of their prison grays and are now wearing ill-fitting and goofy-looking civilian duds. Like they look like tourists. It's really, I don't know, like a low-bar comedy. Back to the ladies. Stephanie recognizes Zonk as the Baffler and also knows that there's a certain Blackgate resident that he usually runs with. Speak of the devil, let's hop back to Artie, who, well, he catches an eyeful of the spoiler and is shocked to see that his daughter is here on the scene. And he tries to guide his crew in the opposite direction as an attempt not to cross paths. Back to the shore, we rejoin Chubbs, who has come to, and, well, clearly he's not happy. Back inside, Arthur realizes that Firefly has wandered off somewhere. And back to the ladies. I mean, we're getting whiplash here. Spoiler tells Huntress that she'd never seen anything like her before. The way she took out Big Zonk, I mean, she didn't even give him a chance. Now, Helena, she's like always on the defensive here. I guess from her interactions with the Bat family, it stands to reason that she would be. And so she takes this little bit as criticism, assuming that she's probably going to be on the receiving end of yet another, you know, cool your jets, Bat lecture. But that's not the case at all. Stephanie's actually sort of kind of given her props for her no-nonsense approach. And she even complains that Robin always plays fair with the bad guys. Helena says that, well, Gotham needs a different kind of hero. She says they need butt kickers, not shining knights. Just then, the girls catch a whiff of something, and that something is gasoline. Bada boom, before we know it, the entire place is flooded in flame. So Firefly, he's off getting his jollies here, pyroing all over the place. It doesn't take but a moment for the girls to KO the creep, though. It's a quick little action scene. Nothing wrong with that. Back to Arthur, and, well, there's nothing wrong with an action scene, but it's another comedy scene. Arthur is there, and he's quite annoyed to see his crew robbing an ice cream cart. Like, they're literally eating ice cream by the handful. He calls them all losers before catching sight of a nearby Gotham Savings and Trust. Back to the ladies. Huntress is begrudgingly dragging Firefly out of the flames. It's implied here that she was completely willing and kind of looking forward to just letting him burn to death. Which, I mean, Firefly might have enjoyed that. Now, Stephanie wasn't about to let that happen, and Huntress attempts to remind the kid that Firefly did just try to kill them. So, what's that about playing fair? Now, Steph goes all, "Hey, Robin says," before being cut off. Helena calls Bat philosophy complete BS. She says right now it's kill or be killed. There's no time for mercy. And for a topper, Helena says the next baddie she sees, she's gonna kill. Back to the bank. Arthur and company are grabbing big old piles of cash, with our main man suggesting that maybe his luck is turning around. And, you know, we get a reminder here. We get a little cutaway reminder that old Chubbs is still on his way. It's kind of like a dollar store version of, like, Doomsday's Walk and Hop to Metropolis over here. It's pretty funny. Anyway, during the cash grab, Stephanie and Helena arrive. Arthur and Steph's eyes meet, and, Well, remember what Huntress said about what would happen to the next bad guy she saw? Well, she intends to make good on that threat. Spoiler, however, spoils her shot by shoving her crossbow gauntlet having arm out of the way, so she can't get a clear shot on her father. Just then, Arthur instructs Monsoon to kill the ladies, which, yeah, pretty effed up when one of them is your daughter, isn't it? Huh. Now, Helena turns to Steph with like a what the hell sort of look, to which Stephanie immediately spills the beans that Arthur Brown, aka the Clue Master, is her father. Huntress is all sorry about your damn luck, and we get us a few crossbow bolts fired and a fight scene. Elsewhere, at the same time, Chubb steals a Humvee, and Arthur and Ratcatcher attempt to find a way out of the mall. Now, the girls' struggle with Monsoon continues for a page or so, ending with Stephanie cracking the back of Monsoon's knee with a steel rod of sorts. And then Helena Monkey flips the big guy off the second level of the mall. He gives us, like, an elongated, after he lands, so I suppose we can assume he survived. Back to the baddies, who are still trying to find an exit, this time through an attached movie theater. Just then, the Chubbsmobile busts on the scene, running over Dragon Cat. Outside the multiplex, Steph and Huntress talk a bit more about her dad being the Clue Master and an all-around scumbag. Helena says, just because Arthur is Stephanie's dad doesn't mean he gets a pass. So, if they cross paths, dude's gonna die. Or at the very least, maimed pretty badly. Speak of the devil again, it's at this point where Arthur comes running out of the theater crying for help. Not a moment later, that Humvee bursts onto this scene. So, not only do we have a lot of swooping, but we have a lot of bursting onto the scene in this one, don't we? Now, Huntress leaps onto the hood of the Chubbmobile, and this leaves only Spoiler and her dad behind, the latter of whom is scrambling to pick up some of the cash he dropped. Frantic, he offers to split the money with Stephanie, but she ain't having it. This father-daughter bonding session is interrupted just then by the rat catcher with his rat whistle. Back to the Huntress, who's still riding on the hood of the Hummer. Chubbs winds up driving completely out of the artwork. Like, the backgrounds are gone. It's just a white void with a sideways Humvee in it. He broke the art barrier, I guess. Back inside the backgrounds, Arthur is running off with cash while Stephanie's being swarmed by rats. For some reason, this makes her pull her mask off. I don't know if a rat got into the... I don't know. Back outside, we see Huntress leap off the hood of the Humvee right before it crashes and explodes. Back inside, and what was that I said about motion sickness before? We're going nuts. Inside, the unmasked Spoiler shakes free of the vermin and chases, well, the vermin that is her dad. She dropkicks him, knocking him to the ground, and he appeals for her to let him go. He suggests that should that other woman find them, he's as good as dead, and Stephanie knows that he ain't wrong. She struggles with this for a moment before ultimately letting him flee. Huntress returns not a moment later, just as Arthur is sliding down some debris to the floor below. Helena asks for a sit rep before collapsing into Stephanie's arms. We close out this issue with the ladies escaping into the shadows just as emergency services arrive. That's where we leave it. Next time out, we're looking at Detective Comics number 721. So let's talk about it here. I thought this was pretty good. I liked this. Going into this crossover event, the one-shots kind of, like, we had the one-shots in the anthology, and those were ones I was kind of iffy about. I'm like, oh, those are just going to be cash grabs. And, I mean, everything's a cash grab in the industry, of course, but I kind of felt like these were going to be hard to get through, definitely hard to parse in, you know, bullet point format and hard to discuss, but so far so good, I think, with the one-shots. We got one left, which we'll probably be getting to next week, but yeah, I dug this. Cards on the table, though, I've never been into the Brown family drama. You know, I loved the old Robin book, but anytime it was an Arthur Brown thing, I kind of glazed over. It's kind of like Ra's al Ghul in the regular Bat books, just no interest. But even with that having been said, I really, really think the moments between Stephanie and Arthur were very well done here. I mean, cinematic in a way. You know, the moment their eyes met, it was just like, oh crap, you know, something's going to have to happen now. we've got good guys and bad guys, and they noticed each other. They're in the same space, and they can't really let on that they're related, and something's got to happen, right? I mean, the fact that Arthur pretty much ordered that his own daughter be whacked by Monsoon, insane and intense, you know? And finally, you know, Stephanie allowing her father to get away before Helena can perforate him with crossbow bolts. Really complicated relationship. And on display like this, it was really, really good. Now, while I enjoyed that interaction, I gotta say the star of the show here was the interaction between Spoiler and Huntress. Definitely the high point of the issue for me. And among the higher points of this crossover, I'd wager. I mean, Stephanie is still young in her crime-fighting career, right? And she really, at this point, only knows first-hand crime-fighting via her association with Robin, who is very much cut from the Batcloth insofar as being, I guess, by the book, right? As by the book as they come. Huntress's approach is different. She's brutal, potentially deadly, and non-repentant. So seeing Steph's eyes open to this flavor of vigilantism was pretty cool. I like how early she was, like, kind of incredulous about Helena's methods, even to the point where she questions them. But she also seems to see the value in being a little bit less fair with those who look to do them harm or just plain do them in. And I tell you, that's just a wonderful layer to add to, you know, Spoiler's young, you know, crime-fighting career. It's really, really cool just to see different methodologies, pros and cons. I mean, no methodology is perfect in this situation. But if you take a little from one and a little from the other, you might be able to come up with your own perfect approach. And so far, Stephanie's only had the vanilla, and now she's getting a little bit of another flavor. And speaking of Huntress and her brutality, I tell you, I'm really, really digging the treatment that Huntress has been getting so far. Like I said when we first ran into her, I have precious little experience nor expertise with this character. I honestly couldn't tell you much outside of how pre-crisis she was the Earth 2 daughter of Batman and Catwoman, and even that I wouldn't swear to on a stack of Bibles, right? For all I know, that might be her story again now. Honestly, Huntress might not even be a thing anymore. That's how out of touch I am with current year DC. So, who knows? But I do really like this no-nonsense approach. Especially in times like these. Post-quake, martial law, chaos reigning in the streets. It's interesting to have a crime fighter with a more black-and-white approach to taking on the bad guys. And I'm definitely looking forward to more from her, especially with what's to come. And the next evolution or role that she's going to briefly slip into as we get into No Man's Land proper. If you know, you know, and if you don't, you're in for a treat. Now, as for Spoiler, I'm drawing a total blank on her No Man's Land involvement. Like, honestly, I couldn't tell you if we ever see her again during the story. As we've been reading these early chapters, I usually say stuff like, well, we just added another one to our No Man's Land chessboard, right? But I honestly don't remember whether or not she'll play a role at all. I really hope she does, since, I don't know, she's kind of sitting under two different learning trees right now. You know, she's got the by-the-book Bat stuff and the more ruthless Huntress stuff. And I think it would be interesting to see whether or not she faces any sort of internal struggle as to how she ought to be fighting crime, especially in this very, very weird No Man's Land landscape, right? Overall, I you know, it's a one-shot, but I feel like it was a necessary chapter. One-shots can be disposable. They can be left out. They could be cash grabs, but I feel like this one was necessary. And it was a nice bit of non-Bat Hero flavor being added to our massive cross event. And it's funny, speaking of the disposability of certain chapters here, I kind of, when I was going through my research initially, and I saw that this was a tie-in, I automatically thought it was going to be like a immaterial, I guess. And also, I figured it was going to be hard to find, because I'd never heard of the thing before I started researching. I mean, it's not often in like Big Two comics that I like learned something existed that I didn't know existed, which sounds pompous, and it is, but like all I'm saying is I'm in the bin so often that it, when I see something that I didn't know existed, it kind of, you know, puts me back. So seeing that this was a thing and never having heard of it before, I thought it was going to be hard to find, and I figured, oh, well, you know, if I have to leave it out, I have to leave it out. But I snapped it up pretty much day one. So, and after reading it and covering it here, I'm glad I did. So again, value-added chapter to the Cataclysm story, and definitely worth your time. Speaking of worth your time, let's hop into the NML bag, where we're going to hear from our good friend CJ, who facilitated a really fun walk down podcasting memory lane for me last episode. He writes in response to my comments. Then, he says, from Claremont to Claremont must have been a beast to prep and organize with all those co-hosts. I wonder how much of your decision was to stop it was tied to the time it needed to prep, and how long the project would go on for, making that prep even more of a burden, and how much was tied to the scheduling of working with so many co-hosts. It was none of that. It was, and it's embarrassing to say, it was petulance and immaturity. I had an expectation with that show. And you can kind of compare it to new parents having to come to grips with the fact that people around them are not going to be as interested in their baby photos as they are, right? They're not going to find them as interesting or as adorable or as whatever as the parents do. I had an expectation with Claremont to Claremont. It was basically the show that I always wanted to listen to. And I projected that onto a phantom listenership that just wasn't there. The numbers that show drew were not what I wanted. And I mean, that's never a reason to do or not do something. I've learned that in the years since. But then, I mean, the shows were 12 to 15 hours long. There were hundreds of hours of work involved in every single episode. It was never a problem scheduling, because everybody was so, so damn cool and accommodating. And like, man, it was such a fun time, because like we would be recording like into the wee hours. And like I would have like marathon recording sessions, like if I could get three people on the same day, and we would just be recording for like 8 hours, you know, after work into the night. And it was a blast. It was an absolute blast, and the people I worked with were wonderful. Just some of the greatest people. And so supportive. But at the end of the day, you know, the buck stopped with me, and I was a baby about it. You put that much time into a project, that much passion and love into a project, and that much novelty into a project, because I made it, or I endeavored to make it more than just a comic review show. You know, there was a lot of personal stuff in there from everybody involved. Everybody was so great. I can't emphasize it enough. But at the end of the day, when like only a handful of downloads would come in, no comments, I petulantly took my ball and went home. It's only punishing myself, but that's kind of what I tend to do. It's something I'm discussing in therapy right now, but we'll continue CJ's message here. He says, I'm interested in general, but since that era of X-Men marked my entrance into comics fandom, it holds a dear spot in my heart. I loved revisiting it in From Claremont to Claremont, and was disappointed when it ended, and always wondered what the straw that broke the camel's back was. Related to this, I always wondered and hoped that one of those reasons might be enough for you to stop the project at the time, but they weren't enough to prevent you from returning to it at some point in the future. To which, I mean, never say never. You know, before I started this show, I wanted to do something for the new year. I've talked about how hard it is not to have a project going during Christmas time. And so I kind of sidestepped that this year by putting all of my effort into putting something together for New Year's. I wanted to start January 1, right? But I couldn't, you know, No Man's Land was always on the radar. It was always there. It was always something I wanted to cover in depth. It was always something I wanted to just read myself personally. But I kind of got into my own head, like wondering if this was too big a project. You know, it's funny. I was going to post, and I probably still will post this today, a thank you to the people in the Facebook group for their kindness and their support, because I do a lot of projecting, and I didn't even know whether or not I was going to promote this show, because I figured if I did, and this is me projecting very unfairly on people who have been nothing but supportive and kind to me, I kind of figured they'd roll their eyes and be like, oh, well, here we go again. Because my track record's been garbage. I mean, garbage would be putting it nicely. But I worried that people would see like this massive undertaking. There's like 135 parts to this series. And, you know, I haven't been able to do anything of late. So I worried that people would be incredulous and just be like, eh, well, we'll see how long this lasts. So anyway, I wanted to have something going January 1st. And I was thinking about just calling it like something like The Kick. Because like, as comic fans, we get on certain kicks, right? It's like for a while last year, I was on a Daredevil kick. Then I was on a Nightwing kick. And then, you know, dipping into the Titans for a kick, you know. And then it would kind of make it like a wide open sort of program where if I got tired of reading about the Titans or if I got tired of Daredevil, I could just jump to something else and be like, oh, hey, yeah, I'm on a Nightwing kick right now. Let's talk about that for a while. So again, I mean, never say never. I might get on an early 90s X-Men kick again. But right now, I feel like I'm still getting my footing back. I'm still trying to reestablish not even myself as a presence, because I don't consider myself a presence, but just reestablishing a routine for myself and organization for myself. And also trying to make amends with anybody who I might have let down. And I mean, over the past few years, I've been a part of some really, really great projects with some really, really, really talented and great people, great friends that I ghosted. I left. I just vanished because, you know, the cliche life got in the way and I just couldn't handle stuff. And I don't know. I kind of get into my own head sometimes. I mean, shows like Maze Lighting with Ed Moore, we heard nothing but good things about that show. Nothing but good things. People enjoyed it. And we enjoyed it. And I just got into my own head about it. Quester Days with Chris Bailey, another one people really enjoyed. To the Choir with Dave Schultz, another one people enjoyed. Learn Me the Legion with Al Sedano, where I was finally going to learn why people care so much about the Legion, because I can't wrap my head around that. We did an episode. It was great fun. I learned stuff. I shared stuff. People enjoyed it. And yet, they sit in limbo because of me. Back to CJ. He says, also, somewhat selfishly, I was always interested in joining From Claremont to Claremont as a guest or a co-host, but I discovered From Claremont to Claremont right before it ended, so that was never to be. Even as a suggestion from me, maybe a single co-host for all the titles would have made the project easier, although it would have curtailed some of that clubhouse atmosphere you described in the episode. Shameless, selfish questions and hopes, I know. I would have loved to have you on if we were still doing it, because, you know, there was always room, because, I mean, X-Men one-shots were plentiful and almost constant. Wolverine popped up in every third book back then we could cover. It was a lot of room. And, I mean, we were probably going to get to a point where episodes would be unwieldy to produce. Like, a month's worth of X-Books would have been 30 hours worth of podcasting. So it would have been broken up regardless. There was a lot of room, for sure. The clubhouse atmosphere was definitely a huge part of that program and project, and it was what I wanted from it. that's the form I wanted it to take, because, I mean, we were all of a similar age. We were all kind of, you know, Gen X cohorts, right? And we all had different experiences and different introductions. And some folks were DC fans reading X-Books for the first, the 90s X-Books for the first time, you know? Some were there in the trenches, just like I was. Some were just discovering them. Some were leaving them, you know? One of the things that I wanted to do as part of that show was going to, I was going to include X-Men Classics. And that was going to be Reggie's segment because, you know, he enjoyed the Claremont stuff. He never followed the X-Men like 100%, but he always kind of associated it with the Claremont stuff. And when, you know, the Lobdells and Nisi Aces and the red of the blue and gold came in, he, you know, kind of figured that was, you know, done for him. So I thought that was going to be, that would have been a very fun thing to have, just as a, I don't know, kind of a in the looking glass sort of situation for going contrast with everything else that was being discussed in the show. CJ continues, "That written piece that you and Reggie had planned on, turning the collector series into a more formal and data-driven piece, sounds interesting. I understand the decision not to complete and publish it, given that it was a dual project of yours and Reggie's, so I guess I'll just have to hope for Lucian's Library to read it in my dreams." And you know, a lot of what I talk about in regards to collecting is backed by the data that we collected, you know, and also bits and pieces that we gleaned from various conversations we've had with fellow comics enthusiasts. There was a lot of formal stuff, there is a lot of formal stuff in those docs, but there's also a lot of very casual stuff, because comics collecting is a soft science, right? I mean, it's not anything hard and fast. People come and go from the hobby. People have different experiences and different memories and different approaches. And some people take it more seriously than others. And those who don't are probably well more better adjusted to live in real life than me. But a lot of what I talk about here, I mean, even the silly stuff about the Indicia that took up a few minutes of this episode, that's all stuff that was backed by the data. So while that'll most likely never manifest in the form of like a pseudo peer-reviewed piece of academic literature, it does come out every now and again, and will likely continue to. Back to CJ, he says, "On the collecting slash addiction topic, I'm reminded of a podcast I listened to about hoarders. I'm not saying you, me, or most comic collectors are hoarders, but something that podcast mentioned did connect to me as a comic collector, and at some points you made here and have in the past. In that podcast, they mentioned some research about how hoarders have something slightly different or magnified going on in their brain when they're looking at their collection. If I remember correctly, it was something about how the memory processes ideas and some other areas fired more, bringing hoarders back to a time in their life when they acquired whatever item they're looking at and doing so more powerfully than the average person. By extension, getting rid of these items is more akin to getting rid of a memory and a piece of their identity than it is for non-hoarders." And you know, I think there is a lot of power that our collections hold over us, right? And it's everything you mentioned here, memory, identity. It's such a deep topic. And it's one that so rarely gets a fair shake. And that was one of the things that Reggie and I wanted to shine a light on is, you know, and I've said it before and I'll say it again, and it's probably a criticism at this point, but like comic collectors have this like linear timeline of these books that came out at certain points in their lives, their entire lives in some cases. And, you know, and one of the things I used to say back during Reggie and my Real Comics History series, is that comics history is our history in a lot of different ways. And, yeah, I think that's something we can, as collectors of periodicals, can like just, we just see ourselves in at different stages in life, different ages, different homes, different contexts. It's just, it's very, I don't know, it's deep. It's kind of deep. And you know, like I said, it's so rare that something like that gets a fair shake, because I don't know, when collecting for lack of a better term, gets exploited by, you know, shock pieces or reality TV, it kind of blurs the line between collectors and hoarders. You know, one is, you know, clinical and one is passion. And I mean, again that maybe it is a blurry line. I don't know. But personally, I've had people see my library and say stuff like, "Ooh, this looks like a hoarder's house," which is like really annoying. And I hate that that's such an easy go-to observation for seeing a collection. I mean, I do have a crippling comics addiction and a sizable collection, but I mean, it's taken me 35 years to amass. It stands to reason that it would be large. I mean, it's not necessarily disorganized, it's just a lot of boxes. I don't know. Back to CJ. He says, again, I'm not saying we're hoarders, but I do think we have some of that element in our brain, and our memories firing more strongly when we look at and handle physical copies of our comics, which is one of the reasons digital will never replace physical in my mind. He says, I'll read digital in addition to physical, but never only digital, and never more digital than physical. I do think this connection breaks down for this reason, at least, and it's why I think we comic collectors generally aren't hoarders. Hoarders hoard everything, even discarded food wrappers, for instance. And most comics fans only have comics or a few things that they collect. I like to think of this as getting the best of both worlds. And I agree 100% with everything you just said. I will read digital as convenience. Like if I'm waiting in a doctor's office, or if I'm somewhere where I just have time and I don't want to carry around a stack of comics, and I can just carry, you know, my little tablet and do whatever I need to do. You know, kill a few minutes reading whatever pops up on Marvel Unlimited or Hoopla or whatever I have access to. I mean, even for this project that we're working on right now, I could have popped onto Hoopla and read the whole thing, or just covered them issue by issue through that, never holding a physical copy of them ever, never being able to see a letters page or any of the ephemera or any of the ads, and it would have been fine, you know? But I feel like I needed to have them. Because, I mean, eventually we're going to get into letters pages that cover books that we've read, right? Eventually we're going to get there. So I'd like to be able to cover that. I'd like to be able to discuss that kind of stuff. I don't know, the digital feels like we found a cheat code, you know, like we're stealing, kind of. Even if we're paying for it, it feels like we're stealing. I can't explain it, but definitely a lot of that goes to our memories and being able to look back on where we were when certain things came out. And the ephemera included in a physical comic book, which we do not call floppies here, is a big part of the memories that are held in these things, right? But no, I agree 100% with what you just said. CJ continues, I also agree that the Hox Pox era of X-Men has been too bloated, and that an anthology series might have been the way to prevent that problem from happening. I'm not as down on the era as you seem to be, or get to. I still largely enjoy it more than most X-Men from the past 15 years, and maybe I enjoyed it more because I wasn't covering every issue for a podcast. But I do agree with it being bloated and stretched too long for sales. It reminds me of the 90s Clone Saga debacle, which should have been shorter but was elongated due to sales figures. I know that financial considerations drive creative decisions, especially in risk-averse corporations, but I wish there was a better balance between financial considerations and creative considerations, ironically said the unapologetic 90s comics fan. And yeah, I agree, and you know, I probably enjoyed this era of X-Men more than anything since Morrison. So it's not to say I hated it, or it was bad, or it was even bad in any way. I mean, it was a different take, sure. But the X-Men that we've gotten since Morrison, like Morrison to Hickman, was not great. I mean, it was really not great. And I know a lot of that had to do with the movie rights and whatnot, and it was really a shame. The X-Men were treated like orphans. It was just not a good time to be an X-Fan. So yeah, the Hox Pox era was strong, in comparison to most X-Books that we've gotten this century, but definitely bloated. And I can totally appreciate that I had probably become the absolute worst measuring stick for X-Men discussion and reviews toward the end there. Because doing an episode for every single issue that a mutant showed up in, that's a lot of stuff. That's a lot of books. It's a lot of time spent. I would bet that I was literally spending more time with these issues than the people writing and editing them. And I mean, I don't say that to brag. I don't say that because it's nothing to brag about. But it kind of just is. I would bet that there are certain creators and editors out there that spent less time on these issues than I did. I might lose that bet, but I'd still make it. But yeah, I was definitely the worst measuring stick at that point. Familiarity, contempt, yada, 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 yada. CJ closes out with, as always, thanks for the good work and I look forward to more. Well, I tell you what, CJ, I look forward to more discussions like this. I get to kind of bare my soul a bit and go down memory lane and just talk off the cuff, which, I don't know, it's fun to do. It's nice to do. It's therapeutic. So thank you so much for evoking these thoughts and facilitating these discussions. I definitely look forward to more of the same. And I mean, before long, we're probably going to have these comic collecting conversations right out on Front Street. So thanks again. And of course, anybody out there listening who wants to get involved, I encourage and invite you to do so. You can find me several different ways. Chris is on InfiniteEarths.com, WeirdComicsHistory@gmail.com, 90sXmen on Facebook, Ace Comics on Twitter. Now, I probably could go on for another 15 minutes and break an hour here, but instead I'll just let you get on with the rest of your day. Of course, I'd like to thank you all so much for sharing some of it with me. And until next time, as always, I'll talk to you again real soon. See ya. Makes it hard.